Relationships, Is Anything Else Important? Was presented by Eric Beck with a response by Nancy Scott on October 20th, 2007 at the 2007 Oktoberfest entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This next session is on the topic of relationships. And is Kelly going to join you? Another Gutenberg graduate, Eric Beck, is going to be our presenter and our tutor who is going to facilitate and have a conversation with Eric afterwards is Nancy Scott. So I'm going to let you guys, do you have your mics? Okay. Are those ready to go? Okay. Thanks.
Gutenberg alumni, which sounds weird. After listening to David last night, I realized that I just wanted to take a moment before I start to thank all the tutors and thank the donors and thank the board members for making Gutenberg happen. It sounds like right now is kind of a discouraging time, and David said he was convinced that at least a handful of people have been significantly changed by Gutenberg. I'm going to have to put myself near the top of that list. As I was driving home last night, I was thinking, man, I've got to be the most changed person by Gutenberg, and then Toby came to mind. And I figured that maybe I tie for first or I'm in second place, but that's still significant. So I just really want to thank you guys. I'm seriously indebted to you, even more than my school loans would show. So I've been asked to talk about how an individual in our generation views personal relationships, or relationships in general, not personal relationships. And I decided to kind of expand that topic and include human interaction at large. How does an individual in my generation view human interaction as a whole? And since that's a huge topic, I decided to bring it back down and use case studies in terms of how does an individual in my generation view American culture and government, how does an individual in my generation view religious institutions, and particularly the Protestant church, and finally, how does an individual in my generation view personal interaction, one-on-one interaction, or small communities. But before I jump into that, those topics, I want to do just a real quick intro. Namely, I want to talk about how an individual in my generation might view himself, because there's a common thread, I think, in our own self-perception that I think influences the way that we interact with society at large. That common thread is that I think our generation, and obviously we're painting in huge, broad strokes, and I might just be telling you more about myself than my generation. I realized this when Walter was speaking, because there was a lot that I connected with, and there was a lot that I was like, oh man, I don't feel that way, and so here we are going to argue about what our generation thinks. But I feel like an individual in my generation feels like the way he interacts with society is he is an individual, he or she is an individual against the system, that there is this the system that is out there, that is society, that we are disconnected from, that we don't have any participation in, that it somehow oppresses or controls the way that we live, and that that's just the way reality is. I would define the system as those political forces, social forces, economic forces that shape life and shape the way that we do life. Examples that I thought of are kind of like the mass thinking or mass consciousness or groupthink that we see portrayed in the media or in churches. And more poignantly, I think globalization. I think that globalization is something that is on the forefront of a lot of people's minds in my generation, and that is very much a picture of the system, that there is this force, economic and political force, that is bringing American culture and bringing Western corporations into the whole world and changing world cultures, and that's just going to happen. I am not a part of that. Nobody's asked me to be an integral part of that process and to think how that's going to happen. You know, it's going to happen without me. It's going to happen despite me. And I really can't do anything about it. But as hard as I try and as many Jay shirts as I wear, globalization will march on. And that will be a reality that I have to deal with. So that idea of me versus the system, I think, is something that our generation, or something that I feel in particular when I'm dealing with things like American culture, government, and church. Real quick, I need to check what time it is so that I know when I'm going over. That means I got about 5 free minutes there, because it's 10:15, and I'm going to go to 10:45. Okay. Nancy tells me I got more time than that. So since I got 5 free minutes, I'm going to show you a music video that I think in some ways portrays what I'm talking about. When I watched it, I was like, wow, this is the ethos that I'm trying to get across in terms of person versus system. It might not say that to you, but I want to give it a swing. So this is a music video by a band called Gorillaz, and the title of the song is El Mañana. Okay, so I'm not going to comment on that. We can talk about that later if you guys have questions. So let me hop into the topic of how an individual in my generation views American culture and government. To start with, I'm going to give a couple anecdotes. I read a couple months ago Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, and as I was reading through that, it hit me that there was an attitude or an ethos that the people that Tom Brokaw is writing about, the generation that lived through the Great Depression, fought in World War II, and came back and built America as we know it, that they had a certain idea that they had a duty to American, the American village, and that they had a duty to the people here, that they had some sense of participation in America and how it was, that if they didn't like the way America was, they had the ability and responsibility to change it. And it hit me that that is significantly different than the way I've ever viewed my life and my participation in this country. Different enough that I wasn't like, oh, I disagree. It was like, whoa, I've never thought of it in that way before. To show you the way I kind of have thought about it, I'll tell you a story about after my freshman or sophomore year in college, I went home to Sacramento and was driving along the road and had this moral dilemma. And you guys are going to laugh, but like it was literally a moral dilemma about the fact I was driving on the right side of the road. I was feeling this pressure that I had to drive on the right side of the road and I couldn't drive on the left side of the road. And it wasn't because of safety reasons or, because it seemed wise to me. It was purely because I was going to get arrested if I did it. There's another story. There's a stop sign in our little town of Brownsville. It's in the boonies. There's never been a wreck there. I think I'm one of three cars that drives by that intersection a year. And it's a T-bone, and it's a three-way stop. Why it's a three-way stop, I have no clue, except I have a hunch. It's a three-way stop, except for, like, the fourth way is a driveway for a rich person. And I decided that they lobbied Brownsville because they were tired of people running through there and that they actually wanted the ability to just, like, drive out of their driveway and move on, knowing everybody had stopped for them. So when I pull up to that intersection, I now actually force myself to run the stop sign for justice sake, hoping that there's not a cop on the other side, which would be my luck, because I've gotten busted for that stuff before. As you can see, what I'm trying to draw out is that there's this attitude of, I don't participate in American government. I think the World War II generation would stop at that stop sign, even if they didn't like it, because they said, I elected the people that created government. They made these laws. I might think they're stupid laws, but this is the way the system works. I believe in the system, so I'm stopping here. I have to somehow rage against the system because the system is oppressive to me. It is something that is outside of me and controls me, and I have no participation in. And so there's actually a virtue in my mind to running that stop sign because if I didn't, I'm just part of the herd mentality. I have the choice to be the herd and not get the ticket, or run the stop sign and be a strong individual standing up for truth and justice and all that, and then pay my fine afterwards for it. My wife, Kelly, is a school teacher, and one of the classes she teaches is a high school writing class to some homeschooled kids. It's a Monday homeschool co-op thing. And so in this writing class, she asked them, what is government? As kind of a small, open-ended question. And remember, we're talking about homeschool, super, uber conservative kids here. She asked them, what is government? And the answers that came back were shocking to me. The answers that came back from these high schoolers were, government is that group of people that takes our money. Government is that group of people that tells us what to do. Government is that group of people that takes away our freedom. Very much this idea that government is an outside pressure and an outside force and an outside culture that we have to contend with one way or the other. And not only government, but I think that American culture at large, just kind of the consumerism. There was another music video that I wanted to play for you that, for whatever reason, won't play. But it's a video of it's a mainstream band kind of singing out their guilt and regret for the way America has treated the rest of the world. It's a montage of clips of like people eating at fast food restaurants and people starving in Africa. And I just thought the attitude in the montage is very eye-opening about how our generation feels disconnected and feels ashamed for what America is doing in the world at large. So as you can see, there's a disconnect between me or an individual in my generation and the American system at large. That I don't feel like I'm a part of it. I don't feel like I can change it. I don't feel like I can influence it. I wrote down a few things that I think have contributed to why that disconnect has happened, why the World War II generation felt like they had some influence. I don't know what you guys think, and I'm curious to hear if you feel like you had some sense of being able to change things, but I think you did because you lobbied to get the Vietnam War to end, and it eventually ended. I imagine that you felt like you had some participation in that. And I think a shift has happened into my generation. Real quick, the reasons I think for that are, one, there's a shame for American history. I think that Walter touched on this as one of the things that I hardly agree with him on, is my entire education basically taught me to not love America and love American history. And I'm not talking about my school education, because that's a whole other story, but growing up with what I read, watching TV, I was the most patriotic kid you will ever meet. For a long time, until I watched a show on how the West was won and began to study the Indian Wars and was shocked and devastated at what had happened in American history. And it actually made me regret being an American and hate being an American for a long period of time until I continued to study. And actually, I think I'm more balanced and regained a respect for what we've done right. But those things in history, the Vietnam War, the American Indian Wars, Watergate, different things have really contributed to a sense of shame or regret for the way America has been. Definitely there's a shame for American policy and politicians currently. So Americanization, globalization, just the kind of shallow cheesiness of politicians, the lack of dialogue that Jack talked about last night, huge contribution to, I think, why we feel like that I'm disconnected. I'm watching that on TV and going, that's a different style of human than I am. And then I wrote down Ashamed of American Affluence, which I think is what I was talking about a second ago with the music video and just the wealth that we have, the yachts that we have, the amount of food that we eat, and there's starvation going on. That disconnect and the fact that I feel like we're not doing anything about it or I'm not doing anything about it makes me feel somewhat segmented from American culture at large. And finally, there's a feeling of what can I do to actually influence American culture and government? Does my vote actually matter? Does my opinion matter? Kind of a feeling that there's two parties, they're each going to put up a candidate, they're the same candidate in different bodies, and my vote isn't going to change anything. Both parties are the same thing, and if I vote for the Green Party, it's a vote for, is it which one? I forget what my dad always tells me. If you vote for the Green Party, it's a vote for the Democrats, I think he's saying. I don't remember. So there's kind of a feeling of helplessness, or I'm not going to change the way American government works or American culture. There were a host of music videos I could have shown at this point, and I found one by a band called Rage Against the Machine. Even the title, I thought, was perfect and exactly what I was talking about. And I went on to iTunes to download it, and they don't carry Rage Against the Machine, which I guess means the machine is raging against them. So you'll just have to trust me that, you know, this is something that our generation is creating art about and feels very strongly, especially Rage Against the Machine. So the next topic I wanted to talk about is how an individual in my generation views the church. And I wrote out three responses that I saw. And this is by no means meant to be all-encompassing, but I saw three general trends. The first is that I think people in our generation are leaving the church. I read an article in USA Today that said of mainline Protestants, 70% that grew of mainline Protestant kids that grew up in the church, 70% are leaving the church between the ages of 18 and 23. So basically, Christian high schoolers are getting into college, and by the time they graduate from college, 70% of them will leave the church. And I'm sure that there's the typical, like, every generation has had the, I go to college and find out that there's girls and beer and I have a hangover on Sunday morning so I don't go to church, or some, you know, cultural equivalent of that. I'm sure that has happened in every generation, but 70% is a huge number, and I think there's a different reason for that. There's such a high attrition rate, there's got to be something going on there. And what I've noticed in myself and in other people in my generation is I wrote down three reasons why I think that, why I have had that drive and why I think other people have had the drive to leave the church. The first is that the church is irrelevant, and I've just used a loaded term, so I'm going to take some time to describe what I mean by the church is irrelevant. When I say that the church should become relevant, I'm not talking about the church should build more gyms, should show more movies, have more pizza parties, or talk in some hip way. I actually feel like that makes the church more irrelevant, even if more kids are going to show up for a youth group. I think they end up getting the larger youth groups, but those kids get into college and deal with life hardship or deal with, you know, some form of reality that's taught in the university, and they will drop out because the church has been irrelevant to them. I would define relevance as the church actually addressing the issues that are needed to be addressed to our generation. So not necessarily felt issues, but truly needed issues. The example that I'm going to use is, has anybody read Blue Like Jazz by Donald Miller? A few people. Let me give you really quick the recommended reading list for understanding this generation's view of Christianity real quick. This is completely subjective and personal, but this is what I think expresses kind of an ethos. Blue Like Jazz by Donald Miller, Relevant Magazine, Irresistible Revolution by Shane Claiborne. The two books that I mentioned have been huge books, bestsellers in the past couple years, and running around in youth groups. I taught youth group for a while, and running around in youth groups, these are the books that kids were reading and going, oh my gosh, I didn't know people were saying this, but this is exactly what I've been feeling. Donald Miller had the experience of growing up in the church and hearing the words and hearing the language of the church and imbibing it all and thinking he knew what it meant, but not really knowing what it meant. He lived in Portland at the time and also was very involved in kind of a grassroots, like, anti-globalization, you know, kind of hippie Portland culture attitude, and looked out at globalization or American affluence and said, that's sick, that's evil, felt a disgust for it. and saw himself as a freedom fighter against it, until he realized that he was actually participating in globalization by, you know, like buying jeans at Gap or something like that. In making that realization that he was participating in the system that he hated, he finally understood what sin meant. Wow, I'm a sinner because I'm doing things that I view as disgusting, as repulsive. And he finally understood what sin meant. So all through his life, he had been taught, you're a sinner, sin is X, etc., but it had no impact on him, no emotional impact. There was no connection between the word sin and reality for him. I think because the church was not able to connect with him on a relevant basis. It was not able to use language that actually brought the terms home. He had to make the connection in his own way of, wow, this is what selfishness looks like. I feel a hatred towards these actions that are going on, and I just realized that I'm part of that. I would define the irrelevance of the church as actually largely a language issue, that the church has its own set of language and concepts that it teaches kids and wants them to imbibe and be able to speak back, and that it actually has zero connection to the 21st century. End of rabbit trail one. Number two reason that I think kids are leaving the church is, and this has been addressed by all the speakers so far, is kind of the issue of, can we know truth? I think there's a strong attitude in this generation of that truth is either hard to find or impossible to find. And the church is an institution that basically is there to tell you what the truth is. Because we have an attitude of truth is hard to find or you can't find it, dogmatism becomes abhorrent. And I think there is a large number of churches that actually find a virtue in some sense of being dogmatic, because that's a stronger faith. If you state it loud enough and hard enough and you don't entertain questions, that means your faith is very strong. That rubs me the wrong way, and I think it rubs a large majority of my generation the wrong way, in that we are a generation of questions. We are a generation that feels a tension of, I can't be dogmatic about the truth. I'm not sure about these things. Even if I believe these things, I believe that the Bible is the authority, there's still a sense in which I'm holding on to that and I'm not sure about that. And when you get up and say, don't we know that the Bible is the authority, bow down to it, I don't resonate with that. That rubs me the wrong way, hits me as arrogant, and I have a hard time being in that kind of a church. And finally, I think that church tends to not reflect the reality that we view, and I saw this as kind of a sliding scale between, there's two different ways that church loses contact with reality. There's like the Sunday school way of the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus on the felt board that likes little kids and holds lambs. And when you get into reality and one of your friends dies, that Jesus has nothing for you. You realize that church doesn't reflect reality, that message has nothing to do with your life, and so there's a desire to leave that message. On the other side, which is kind of the church that I grew up in, there's a very doctrinaire church. My church was basically consumed by the debate between Calvinism and Arminianism, and it was kind of viewed, it was a Calvinistic church, and it was kind of viewed that to give glory to God is to have your doctrine correct. That if we really understood and really could express the fact that God elected us and that we didn't choose our salvation, that would bring more glory to God than, you know, the Arminian view, or even ignoring the issue. So I spent most of my growing up years rehashing that argument over and over and over again, and then got into high school and started dealing with life and was like, wait a sec, why do I care about that issue? That has nothing to do with my life or the issues that I'm dealing with. I felt like there were much larger issues of how to love people, how to live in the 21st century or 20th century back then, all the way back then, that were never addressed because they were so concerned with getting across a certain doctrine. And I feel like that is probably a tendency in a lot of churches, and that the church loses a touch on reality through that, and therefore is not attractive to people in our generation. And so, thus, three reasons why I think 70% of kids growing up in the church leave. There's another attitude that I've seen kids take towards church, which is to change it from the inside. And I saw this particularly if you go through Relevant Magazine or read Irresistible Revolution. There is an extremely heightened energy behind changing the church and making the church what they view as pursuing true Christianity. And I know that that's got to be a force in every generation. There's always an energy to reform the church. But I think that we're doing it in a classically us fashion. Probably the main drive that our generation has is to make the church more personal and more communal. We're not into sacraments. We're not into formality, traditions, denominations. We're into personal connection, ecumenical groups of people coming together and having dialogue. There's a kind of undercurrent drive called new monasticism of people that are doing church by moving in with each other, and a lot of times moving into lower income areas and ministering to homeless people. And there's an energy there that says, this is what Jesus was about. This is how Jesus lived. He lived with poor people. We're going to do that, and we're going to live together and love each other and really not talk a whole lot about doctrine, but more talk about, and when I say doctrine, I'm meaning kind of like systematic theology. We're going to give up systematic theology and talk more about how do we actually live as Jesus lived. I think that's all I'm going to say about that. And I'm rushed over that issue, but that doesn't mean it's a little issue. Like, I think that there's actually a huge undercurrent of kids with that attitude and exploring those issues right now. I think it seems to me a pretty big issue right now. And then finally, the third response is move to what I called high church, which is exactly what Walter was talking about. I've noticed I think it's a minority, but I've noticed an interesting draw to the Catholic Church, Orthodox Church, Episcopalian Church, kind of the more traditional high church forms. And I think that there is, these people are seeking a depth and a substance that those higher churches seem to offer that the kind of mainline Protestantism tends to not offer. I think they're seeking kind of there's an awe that happens in those churches that you're not going to get in a mainline church. I think that there's a seeking for a security in truth. So, you go to the Catholic Church, they, in some sense, have been teaching the same thing since, for 2,000 years, presumably since, the apostles or something. That's what they claim. And so going and becoming part of that tradition gives you some security in truth, and that I, as an individual, how am I ever going to come to a knowledge of Christianity or truth on my own when I've got 2,000 years of heritage here to argue against? I'm going to trust them. I'm going to go with that. And then finally, I think that they're seeking a connection to heritage or seeking a connection to something larger than themselves, that we're a generation that's basically disconnected from everything, that life is no bigger than myself. And by connecting to something like the Catholic Church, I'm connecting to a tradition and an organization and a movement that's much larger than myself. And that I think that's a draw. Finally, I want to talk about how an individual in my generation views personal connection or personal relationships. And I looked at the given title to my talk on the website 2 days ago, and it was something to the effect of personal relationships, is there anything else? And I went, I'm glad that's my title, because that's my first point in this paragraph here, is that I think due to the fact that we have this sense of individual versus the system, that we feel disconnected from most forms of society, maybe all forms of society, the one thing that we have is connection with the individual. As one of my friends put it, we are the generation of micro communities. And I would understand micro communities as my connection with another human being, or kind of small organic groups of people that come together for a similar purpose. So like my group of buddies that gets together on Friday nights to play poker. That's a micro community. I think personal relationships or micro communities avoid the pitfalls of the system in a few ways. One is that I can trust this person sitting across from me in some sense. I don't feel that, you know, if I have a connection with them, if we're friends, I don't feel like they're trying to sell me something, that they're trying to convince me of something or get me onto their bandwagon. I trust them. We're here just for the sake of the connection. There's also a sense that the connection that we have is real as opposed to doctrine or ideology, because we distrust ideology and doctrine. The author of one of those books that I mentioned, Shaden Claiborne, had a quote that I will misquote because I forgot to write it down. He said something to the effect of, we postmoderns don't connect to doctrine and ideologies, even if they're true. It's through personal connection, personal experience, and stories that we connect and really learn truth in some sense. And so my connection with a person sitting across the table from me is really the way that I'm going to find reality in some sense. It's a hard thing to talk about, but hopefully you're picking up what I'm talking about. And finally, let's use my poker group as an example. I'm an integral part of that poker group in a way that I'm not a part of larger communities. My buddies call up and say, hey, we're playing poker on Friday, are you in? I go, no, I'm working that night. And they go, oh, we'll reschedule. That feels really good to have a group of people want to get something going, want to do something, and then not do it because I'm such an important part of that. That if I'm not there, man, it's not going to happen. We're going to wait till Eric can show up. I don't feel that with larger groups of people. And there's a sense in which that's obvious. I mean, you're not going to go to a church and have them stop church because you're not going to show up, or the American government call me up and, hey, are you up? No, I'm sleeping. And okay, we're going to hold off operations till you wake up. That's absurd. But I'm pointing at a larger issue of, I don't feel connection or an integral part of very many things except smaller groups of people and my personal relationships. Something that David and Walter were talking about is purposelessness. I think that purposelessness is a huge factor in our generation. It's something that I struggle with all the time. And I think a large part of that is that there's nothing that I play an integral part in. My life is mine to live, and I choose what I do with it, and there's really no purpose behind it. I'm not furthering any cause or furthering any organization, and just kind of work to make money so I can buy food so I can sleep and work the next day. So this desire to be an integral part of something and have a purpose, I think, is very tangible. And so I want to conclude with one thought. There's, as we've been talking this weekend, there's a sense of this is this hopeless? It sounds kind of dark. Is it hopeless? And I actually have a feeling that this is an exciting time to live. I'm glad that we're having conferences to dialogue about these ideas, because I feel like there's an important task to be made in connecting and being able to have the two generations talk. I was talking to my wife Kelly a few weeks ago and drew a connection that's really far-fetched, and so I'm going to lay it on you guys now. I compared our generation and its situation with the time of the Industrial Revolution. At the time of the Industrial Revolution, people had, for generations, had grown up on, you know, on the same piece of property, farming, same kind of lifestyle. If, you know, some guy was, say, 24 years old and running a farm and had a family and he wanted to know, how do I do this? He could go to his dad and say, Dad, how do I do this? Or he could go to his grandpa or one of the old men in the village. And they would have wisdom for that guy because they experienced the same thing. They were 24 and were trying to farm and trying to raise a family. And so that guy could go to the old guy for wisdom and be given wisdom that was relevant to his life. I think the Industrial Revolution probably had a major shift in the ability to do that, because all of a sudden a generation moved to the city, wasn't farming, had to figure out how to work an 8-to-5 in the factory and raise a family in the city and interact with people there and figure out what his life was about. And he couldn't go to his dad or his grandpa and say, how do I use my life for, you know, how do I pursue righteousness in this sort of a lifestyle? Because his dad and grandpa had never lived that sort of a lifestyle. He was a pioneer in many ways in how to live righteousness in the city or working in a factory or something. I think that there is, I don't want to be super dramatic here, but I think there's a similar thing going on with our generation versus your generation, and I think your generation versus the generation above you, I think we've just taken it another step further, that there's a disconnect in that we're living in a different world than any generation has ever lived in. One of the examples that came to me is you guys lived in the Cold War, and I was a little kid when the Berlin Wall fell down. I'm living in a post-Cold War generation, and so view international policy and politics in a significantly different way than you guys do, and I've noticed that when I talk to like my grandpa or older people. There's questions that come up of how do I live righteously or how do I love my neighbor when there's people starving in Darfur. I've actually never heard anybody talk about that in a meaningful way. I've never been to a church and had a sermon talk about how I, as a follower of Jesus, should live out love and live out discipleship given the fact that people in Darfur are starving. I think because the information revolution has brought those things to my mind more than it's brought it to other generations' minds. So I just bring those up as examples for, I think there's an important task going on here in that we need to understand each other and be able to talk and be able, I really would love to have you guys teach me how to be a righteous person in this life, but we need to get on the same page and be able to speak the same language to be able to do that. So, all right, open for discussion.
Hi, everybody. I've just really been listening as you've talked, and I have a couple of just observations and clarifications maybe and understanding. I think that it's really true that we've grown up in different worlds, and I think your Industrial Revolution example is fitting in that sense. I had an experience with my own father when I was in my early 20s that revealed that same thing. Like you said, it's gone further now, I think. But similarly, when I was leaving for graduate school, my father was very concerned that I wasn't going to have enough money to live on because I was going to have just a small stipend to go to graduate school with and live on. And we got into quite an argument about that. And I was contesting that I could do it. I could live on $300 a month. It would be a piece of cake. This was, you know, 25 years ago. And he was just convinced that that was the worst thing in the world I could do. And what we finally came to understand about each other, I finally said something like, I finally kind of heard his concern and thought, oh, yeah, you grew up during the Depression. I grew up during all this affluence. You're really scared for me to live on $300 a month because you know what that's like. I have no idea what that's like. Because of the choices you made, I've never lacked anything. And it was like I saw the understanding dawn in his eyes, like, huh, yeah, it's pretty different. And it was a real breakthrough in our relationship. So I feel like I'm having a similar experience with, I think that I can only speak for my experience also in my own generation. I wonder about a way that I see how it's kind of, we started this ball rolling in some ways. And for that, by the way, for any personal responsibility I had in that, I apologize. Because I'm not sure it's been that good of a direction. But I think in that sense, the level at which it has reached now is very, it's so different from my experience that it's very helpful for me to hear your experience and to hear you guys talk about this. And I've been having the experience over the course of this preparation and these conversations of, huh, that's different than I thought. I mean, in terms of it's even different than I thought it was for you. I thought I kind of understood some things, and it's been really shifting for me. So I guess the first thing I want to comment on is the video that you showed. It might say something about maybe the speakers in the church, but maybe that I'm old now. But I couldn't really understand the words in the song, which was unfortunate. But I thought that the visual was extremely powerful. What it communicated to me was how very alone you feel. And it was really powerful to see this person attacked by culture or by the system, by these forces outside of you. That person was completely overwhelmed by this attack and looked also to me very confused by it, like it came out of the blue, like, what did I do? Why is this happening? Really lost and alone and confused. And I thought that was very powerful. It gives me a sense of understanding why it would be so important to you guys to connect in relationships and to build micro communities. Is that kind of, am I kind of getting it?
I think I need to make any more comment on that video. That's exactly why, what I saw in it and why I showed it. So the lyrics actually, it's just a breakup song. It's a song about breaking up with somebody and being lonely. And so the lyrics were actually secondary to the image that I wanted to show with the video itself. So.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm also hearing this larger sense of distrust of, through Walter's talk and what you're saying, this distrust of any kind of authorities and not really having access to a coherent understanding or any kind of truth that's broader than a personal relationship. Is that kind of it? Like, in other words, the truth I'm going to find is between me and you when we share a common experience or when we connect about something. That has the power of truth to it in a way that a proposition really doesn't have. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to...
Okay. That's hard to talk about in one sense, because what does it mean that I find truth in a personal connection? I mean, we're obviously stretching the term truth to mean something other than a statement about reality. But statements about reality, especially on a larger scale, so not like the tree is in front of me, but larger scale is in, you know, something is good versus bad. You know, homosexuality is deviant and heterosexuality is truth. Those kind of things are really thrown up for us. Where in the world am I going to find the answer to that question? So the things that I am now sure about, or the things that I know are important, is my connection with this person in front of me. I care about this person. I need to love that person or take care of that person or listen to that person. That's true, or that's real in some sense. What I think about homosexuality, I have no clue. What am I supposed to do about that? No clue. But this homosexual person in front of me, I can connect with and buy them a cup of coffee and talk. And in some sense, that's real and that's true.
You know, someone who's gay, it changes how you have an opinion about that as a choice, because it's a real person in front of you and not an idea. Is that kind of it?
Yeah, there's definitely a sense to that. Mm-hmm. Somebody told me this story, and I thought it was apropos. There were a few guys sitting around a table and talking about homosexuality, and the first guy was like, yeah, you know, my cousin's gay, and in my experience with him, you know, I've seen this, and blah, 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 and this is what I think about homosexuality, and they were all like, oh, okay. And the next guy goes, yeah, well, my buddy's gay, and this is what I think, and these are the experiences I've had, and wow, okay. And the third guy goes, well, I think homosexual, you know, I read the Bible, and you know, I really believe the Bible's true, and it says homosexuality's wrong, and, you know, that's what I believe. And their reaction to him was, well, don't you know any gay people? What experience have you ever had with somebody that's gay? And he was like, well, no, I haven't really had any. And they said, well, why are you talking about it? What do you know? That personal connection and that experience with the gay person that these two other people had really made them an authority on the truth in some sense that the other guy wasn't. What I thought was interesting, what hit me about that story, is it was told to me by, I don't remember who, but it was at church and was told to me by one of like the elders or somebody in the upper generation saying, isn't this shocking that somebody would think that way? And I heard that and was like, that's the way I think about it. I would have that experience at that table. So
I think we're about out of time. Just in closing, I would just say that I think that it's really important that we keep talking. One of the things that I found when I found myself on the other side of the generation after rejecting and rebelling against my own parents was recognizing over a number of years that they knew some things that I didn't know. That's what they had told me my whole life, but I didn't really believe them. And when I got quite a bit older, I realized, oh, you know, they actually did know a few things. And I don't know that I necessarily know. I mean, I'm not saying that here. What I'm saying is I would like for us to be able to be a resource in some way for your generation. And I hope that by listening and interacting, we can in some way bridge that gap and find ways to support you. Because in very significant ways, it is your world that you're inheriting. We're going. You're coming. So.
Amen.